Hey, and welcome to Sharing Contently, where we want you to fall in love with the content we adore. I'm Jake, and with me is Lauren again.
Hi.
And you had something you wanted to do to introduce us.
So I am Lauren, and I would say I'm going to be the residential bronze-burning seeker of our crew. What about you, Jake?
Probably a coin shot, a steel pusher.
Why coin shot?
You didn't give me a whole lot of time to think about this one, and it's one of the most well-known ones in the book. Like, the more I think about it, I might also want to be a tin eye. I don't know, they're all cool. But we should probably introduce what Allomancy is, why we're talking about it.
And the fact that, yeah, you finally convinced me to go back to Mistborn by Brandon Sanderson. So, thanks, Jay.
You're welcome. So that's what we're talking about today, is the first Mistborn book, The Final Empire.
Yeah.
And Allomancy is the magic system in that uses metals.
So, I obviously have a history with Sanderson. We're positive and negative now, thanks to you. But yeah, I really enjoyed Mistborn. I'm going to just come straight off the
this
bat.
This time,
yes.
Because you tried it, if we recall.
Yeah.
And you rage quit.
I did.
And then I got you onto the graphic audio in Warbreaker, and this time you tried it, and then you tried it again.
Yeah.
And now you're saying you enjoyed it.
I did. And I honestly, the whole movie in your mind concept for me, I definitely experienced so much more viscerally with this. And I don't know if it's because I'd already read 60% of Mistborn, so I could kind of revisit it and have that movie in my mind, or if it was just because graphic audio is fantastic as a format. But yeah, I really enjoyed the book. Definitely still have criticisms with it. Don't get me wrong. And we'll talk about all that. But I really enjoyed it.
I'm glad. That's fantastic to hear. And yeah, I also have criticisms with it, but it is very solid and I would still recommend it to most people. Speaking of, do you have a summary for us today, or are we just going to have to wing it?
No, I have a summary. In the ash-covered city of Luthadel, a wayward orphaned girl, Vin, is under the control of the nefarious thieving crew who abuses her, and the leader only keeps her alive because strange things happen when she is around. Vin possesses a skill she calls luck, which enables her to ever so slightly persuade the people around her. Kelsier, a man with unrelenting positivity and charismatic demeanor, is putting together his own crew, who are seeking to overthrow the Lord Ruler, a godlike figure who is both emperor and omnipotent deity and has ruled unilaterally for 1,000 years. Kel and the Lord Ruler have an interwoven history, where a previously failed coup d'etat by Kel's former crew resulted in he and his wife being sent to a labor camp called the Pits of Hathsin, from which no one has ever come out alive. Kel is the sole exception, though it came at immense personal cost. Determined to succeed in his next coup, Kel is surprised to sense magical powers when scouting a government site, only to find Vin unknowingly using her Mistborn powers to burn metals within herself to persuade a government official. Saving Vin from her wretched life, Kel welcomes her into his crew, giving her a home, family, and the chance to leave whenever she wants, a freedom she is not accustomed to. His crew is comprised of his brother Marsh, the snarky and snobbish Breeze, philosophical muser Hammond, administrator and organizer Doxin, foreign scholar Sazed, war-weary soldier Clubs, and his nephew, a boy that they call Spook, as well as the lesser nobleman Lord Renault, who is allied to their cause. Vin's part in the plan is to impersonate the niece of Lord Renault and infiltrate the noble balls for information which might be beneficial to Kel's cause. The aloof, court eccentric Ellen Venture seeks her out as the new girl at court to spite his father and avoid the suitors interested in him. He is an idealistic man who is consumed by books, some of which Vin discovers are dangerous. Between Vin's information gathering, Kel's organization, the crew's determination and the hard work of their allies, plans and plots play out as an unlikely group of individuals with vastly different ideologies unite to put in place the machinations to free the enslaved masses, conquer a god, and destroy an empire.
You talked about the ash-covered city of Luthadel.
I did.
But you didn't talk much about the fact that this is the final empire and who, like, I think the primary antagonist of the book is the god emperor. What's he called?
The Lord Ruler.
The Lord Ruler, yes.
Yeah.
Who sort of provides the driving force for everything in this very oppressive, bleak world.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting. Your story, your summary really focused on the characters. You seemed very interested in them and you wanted to introduce them. But the world itself was an afterthought. Was that how you felt while going through the book?
I mean, the world is very bleak. And I think, obviously, there's reason for it, which are in the spoiler territory that we are steering clear of until after our outro. Yeah, I definitely felt... I mean, there's only so many times I can hear, there's ash falling from the sky, there's mist at night. I'm like, I get it. It's sad. It's a bad place to be. But I think probably what I don't talk about in the summary that is worth sort of discussing is the social structure.
All of Sanderson's books that I've read certainly deal with some degree of class structure and class stratification. And there's generally an oppressed underclass and a rather happy, wealthy, well-fed ruling class. And Mistborn is the book that makes this most overt and almost focuses on it.
Absolutely. So you've obviously, if you're imagining like a pyramid, at the top you have the Lord Ruler, who is a deity, for lack of a better word, even though, I mean, compared to our previous episode of talking about actual gods, not quite like on that level. It's sort of different. It's like godhood adjacent.
He has ruled for 1,000 years, and in this world everyone seems to have a normal lifespan except him. He possesses very strange powers. The magic system of the world seems to bend to his will. And he's just incredibly reclusive, but still rules the world with sort of an iron fist.
And he also has, obviously, as you see with so many dictators throughout history, a military regime that enforces his will, which is, it's not just military, it's administrative as well, but a very, very much a unilateral, omnipotent rule, and basically running it by proxy for him, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely.
So then under him, you have, I would say, the noble class, and there's, I think, 10 noble families. They keep the logistics of the city and the people and the slaves managed, and all obviously have their own specialties, which is why they're rich, and they have these balls. I think almost nightly they have these extravagant balls that obviously Vin gets to go to. And then under the nobility, you have kind of like a slave class. It's implied that they're a race, but I don't think that they are. And they're called the Scar. And Vin is a Scar, like she was born Scar. It's like a social, I think it's like a caste system, really, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so.
So basically, if you're born Scar, you can't not be Scar. You're stuck being Scar. They are the majority of the population, the peasantry, the working class, the enslaved, and the oppressed.
They're talked about, as you said, as a species. Like the opening chapter, we get a point of view from a nobleman who just considers them effectively animals. They are very much slaves in this sense.
One thing I think we absolutely have to talk about before we get even any further into character discussion and plot development is the magic system, because you are a scholar on this magic system and I'm still like looking up the wiki trying to get my head around it.
The thing that makes Mistborn stand out and the reason it's so well loved is it has this very, very well-defined, rigid magic system that it works a lot in scientific bases, and it's ruined a lot of some magic systems for me, at least, where every action has an equal and opposite reaction. I mentioned about steel pushers who can push metal away from themselves, but if they push something heavier than them, they get pushed. And that leads to all sorts of fun things like them pushing against the ground to fly. And it's just this logical progression of the magic system that is really interesting and used in all sorts of interesting ways. And it's called Allomancy. It's based around these metals that you consume and then burn to do various things. And I want to say that I want to change my answer for what Allomancer I want to be, and I'm going to constantly do this throughout the episode, I imagine. But I want to be a soother, someone who messes with people's emotions, but just makes them feel calm.
No!
I want my friends to feel calm. I want to look after people.
Yeah, but... oh, there's such a philosophical and ethical grey area there that I don't know, we have enough time to unpack. Look, I think it's really interesting, and this is the part that I'm not so good technically at, is there's internal and external metals, right?
Well, you're right and wrong in that there's a lot going on, but it's not fully understood during the first book. The really interesting thing about this magic system is it develops as the series goes on, while remaining consistent, where it's the understanding within the world that develops. Book one has the 8 basic metals and the 2, are they called god metals, advanced metals?
Can't even remember off the top of my head, which is terrible. But then there's the whole myth of the 11th metal, which is kind of used as a rallying cry during, you know, Kelsey's attempts to overthrow the final empire.
Yeah, I'll give you a slight spoiler here. There's more than those 10, 11 medals. There is the whole system goes much deeper and much further.
Oh, I can't even keep track of like 8 of them. How am I supposed to? That is so annoying. Brandon, why?
No, it really makes sense and it will come together in ways that will make even more sense as the series progresses. Yeah, so there's internal medals and pushing and pulling medals and it all overlaps to create a system. But yeah, so Brandon Sanderson will have these hard magic systems, which means that he can put his characters in deeper scrapes and then solve them with magic because we as the audience understand that magic. So if we as the audience figured it out, we will feel smart for going, oh, they did the idea I thought of. And if we as the audience don't figure it out, we go, oh, that's a really clever use of that magic. I hadn't thought of that. And either way, it can be a very satisfying experience.
Definitely. And I think of a couple of examples I don't want to get into, not because they're spoilers, but because it's a nice part of the book where you go, well, that's a clever use of pushing against things for movement, for yeah. instance. So I think you probably know what I'm talking about. But anyway, I really enjoyed it. And again, it could be because I read 60% of it and then I came to it through the graphic audio format that I had a bit more of an understanding and I could grasp the ideas a bit quicker, but it definitely, at least through the graphic audio format, or maybe I was just in a better mood, I could latch onto the ideas certainly better than previously.
Well, this is why I do think, and I enjoy doing rereads of these books, is that there are more you notice once you understand it, and you can't understand it without having already read it. You get a new and different experience from repeat readings or listenings, as the case may be.
I felt much more in it, especially the first half that I remembered. I was like, oh, this is great. I'm back in a familiar setting. Whereas I think anytime you start a new book, you're just like, everything is crazy. What is going on? But actually, that segues nicely into the next thing I want to talk about. On my re-listen/reread, the characters were a lot more distinct to me, especially Kelsey's crew. And I think characters are really interesting in this book because some are fantastic and some are dreadful and there is not a lot in between.
Yeah, I would 100% agree with that.
All right, well, let's just start with the, like, you know that this is going to be a patented, trademarked Lauren rant.
Yep.
Vin. Admittedly, her voice actress in the graphic audio, beautiful, and also gives such depth to a character that when I read her on the page, I was like, legitimately, ah! But anyway, better in the graphic audio, still not amazing. She's just like, it sounds terrible, but like the daydream idea of a perfect girl that doesn't know she's perfect, but you can appreciate she's perfect and revel in the fact that she's doesn't realize she's like too hot for you. You know what I mean?
Completely. I think that that's slightly unfair in that Vin's flaws are all mental and character flaws that she has to overcome. And she still, despite all this, does have a real character arc in this book. Her themes are all about learning to trust others and learning how to interact within society. But from an external viewpoint, yeah, she is an incredibly dull character if you're not in her head, which thankfully you are for a lot of
the book. For most of the book, you're in her head. And I think having her internal dialogue for a lot of the book really helps, because then you can at least be like, oh yeah, you're abused as a child. That's why you're acting this way, because you're having constant flashbacks. I still don't like you as a character. You're still kind of boring. But I can at least understand her, you know?
Yep. I wouldn't disagree with anything you've just
said. I don't like the whole Cinderella complex of, oh, all of a sudden you have these powers and now you're amazing at them because you're naturally gifted.
Yeah, she's too naturally talented at everything. I completely agree with that.
Yeah, and it just comes across as really just inauthentic, I guess, would be the word I'd put on it. But anyway, that's the only ranty part, hopefully.
Can I suggest one other when you've mentioned
Vin? Yeah.
The female representation in this book. Where is it?
Like on a scale of like rage to like hellfire?
Just no, not quite. But like there are.
There's two.
Effectively no.
There's two. There's Shan Alariel and Vin.
Oh, if you want to count Shan as a, yeah, fair
we
enough.
We have to, when there's only two, we need to count a minor character who is a massive, massive pain in the butt.
I will add that Sanderson has acknowledged this as a problem, and I believe there is a screenplay or something being written that he's involved in, and he has changed the gender on, I think it's Doxin.
Oh, I like Doxin.
I like Doxin too, but Doxin can be a woman, and that's fine.
Right.
But it's just this is a real sausage party here.
Yeah, and you get that sense when they're sitting in Clubs' shop planning their evil heist, and it's like, all boys. and just Vin. And even Vin comments, the thing is, she was very aware that she was the only girl in that room. And I was like, Sanderson, you even know this. Remedy this. So second character, obviously, we have to talk about is Kelsier, or Kel, as his friends call him.
Of course.
Look, he's good. I think I messaged you when I started my listen because I was so sort of shocked by the voice actor. It really jarred me in the graphic audio, which is something only you'll encounter in that format. I wanted him to be a bit more like Light Song from Warbreaker. And at first I really didn't like it, but actually as I enjoyed the book and went through it, he wasn't quite as rough around the edges as I had previously interpreted his character in my first attempt at getting through this book.
I think it's important to note that the thing with Kelsier is that he is a character very much of duality. He is this happy, smiling, jovial, joking person, sort of like Light Song, but he has a very real darkness inside of him, and he's got a very, very sharp edge. And that is what a large part of what his character arc is about, is establishing where he fits on that spectrum of how much of a good guy is this hero of the world, actually.
Because he really becomes, I would say, the face and the figurehead of not only the small group, the ruffians and bandits he's putting together, but, you know, for the Scar, who need a figure to look up to as a leader to liberate them, he kind of makes the role his own to really try and galvanize them. But yeah, it definitely does have that edge. You don't see it a lot, which is great, but when you get glimpses of it, it's really satisfying.
Yeah, no, I think Kelsey is probably one of the most well-realized characters in this book, and one of them far more interesting ones because of that depth and duality.
The third character I want to talk to you about, Ellen Venture.
Yep, this has to be the third.
Here's my thing. 16-year-old Lauren would be in love with him because he's bookish and he's noble. He's, you know, got this aloofness. Here's the problem. 28-year-old me likes him a lot too. And I'm not okay with this. Why is that? Oh, he's the prince. He's charming. And I'm like, no, don't give into this. He's part of the problem. He's part of the system. I see you trying not to laugh at me right now. But it's like, oh, this is why I have terrible taste in men. Society has groomed me to be looking at these very problematic men. Anyway.
No, not anyway. Again, I want to say this is probably a very much Sanderson trope of, in literally all of his books, as I said, they have a class structure, and there will be a young male scion who is high up in that class structure, who is very attractive, is aware of the issues of the class structure and its struggles, and will be presented as sympathetic and generally the love interest. It almost feels like it's not the problem. The problem isn't the structure. The problem is the people in the structure. If only they were all like Alan, everything would be fine. And it's like, you're missing the point here.
Yeah.
Like, they're great characters. There is a real issue with the way it presents this class structure and this class struggle that Sanderson wants to write about. Where I understand he doesn't want to villainize all of them because they're not all, like, people are people.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the fact that often they end up in that similar position seems to suggest that the thesis is about the people in charge, not the structure. It is acknowledged in Sanderson's annotations that he understands that Elland doesn't grasp the extent of the problem, and he is the most quote-unquote woke of his contemporaries. And Sanderson is aware that these discussions happen and he's using it to make it feel more real, and because he wants Vin to have that Prince Charming character, and so Prince Charming needs to be aware of the problems and relatable.
You know, there are aspects of Ellen that I think are genuinely quite charming. There's a comment that he has a suit jacket that's got an impression from always having a book in his pocket, and it's like, I can see that. That's actually quite novel, and I know what that looks like. And there's sort of some of his backstory, which we won't talk about here, is quite awful. And he went through something relatively traumatic. And, you know, there are important conversations to be had in those kinds of things. I just worry that that gets lost in this Prince Charming, I'm here to save you. I've got all the power because politically my family are strong.
I think the real issue with Elland is that he doesn't have a character arc in this book. He just sort of exists as a guy that Vin just likes, and there's not
much. And also to further the plot.
And to further the plot. he doesn't... He still has agency, but he doesn't grow in any meaningful way from the beginning to the end.
Let's move on and talk about who we stan, our number one best boy of the book, who is Sazed.
Absolutely. We stan Sazed here.
We stan Sazed. He is... How do you describe him? So he's a terraceman, which is kind of like a professional steward. It's a slightly different ethnicity to everyone else in the book, but that's not really quite clear, at least maybe in this book. And he's very knowledgeable about etiquette and culture, but also religions, which is his kind of niche, is my understanding. Is that correct?
Yeah, so the terracemen are, as you said, professional stewards in this culture. They're highly prized servants that deal with the nobility on a very direct level. But they are also, the best way I can describe them is sort of that Tibetan monk, highly spiritual, well-refined, but very tall and physically intimidating. Sazed has a particular obsession with religions because he is working for the people trying to overthrow the Lord Ruler, and the Lord Ruler has stamped out all other religions. So Sazed is collecting the ones that existed before the Lord Ruler came to power and trying to spread them. And his own little quirk is he loves to try and convert people to religions and sort of finds a religion for them the same way a tailor would find a suit jacket for someone. Of what are you interested in? What do you like? Oh, I know the religion just for you. And there's this ongoing little plot that's just fun.
It's just charming.
Yeah, it's incredibly charming of him telling people about religions of the world that used to exist. And they're really interesting little things. Most of them are only about a paragraph long, but you go, oh, I want to hear more about that. What is this people that worshipped the stars or worshipped colour? Yeah, and Sazed becomes Vin's other mentor along with Kelsier, where Kelsier teaches her to fight and use her powers, but Sazed teaches her why to fight and when not to and how to exist outside of that world of combat and death and destruction.
Absolutely, and I think as well he's a friend first and kind of like that parental figure she needed, but accepts that she's a young adult. He doesn't baby her, whereas Kelsey is more very, very affable, and I think he forgets that she's, what, all of 16 and very not worldly, whereas Sazed's like, I understand that you don't know how to curtsy. I'm annoyed. This is the 50th time I've had to teach you, but let me teach you one more time, you know? That's much more Sazed's lane with her.
How good is Sazed?
He's just such quality.
So you mentioned Kelsey's little crew, and I wanted to talk about a thing. And you talked about them pulling off a heist, and Sanderson really wrote this book because he likes heist stories and heist novels. So they come together as a crew, and it does try and follow those heist tropes. But I really want to ask, because I love heist stories, did this feel like a heist story to you?
In parts it did. I think it gets lost amongst Vin's narrative of going to the ball and being pretty at balls and getting intelligence, because there are aspects of the machinations of the planning and the plotting and the radicalizing of Scar and arming them and trying to build up an army. It didn't stand out to me as much, but it definitely is there. I would say, without spoiling it, it definitely doesn't low into that for the last third. I think the whole tone of the novel shifts in the last third, though.
I don't really feel it was there at all. I think Brandon Sanderson carried the tropes and he included them, but it doesn't have the tone of a heist novel.
That's it.
And as you say, you know, it follows Vin, who's having her own little journey, and she's by far the main character, and she's going to balls and things. And you can have balls in a heist novel, but that plot line doesn't intersect. And then there's the army plot line and arming the Scar, and that plot line doesn't intersect, and it's just
lots of threads.
I'm actually very disappointed by this because I, as I said, love heist stories and I love heist novels and I love just all of that stuff, and I really appreciate that Sanderson wanted to write one, and I'd love to see him actually try and do one again now that he's more experienced, because this one doesn't do it and it's really sad. It's still great, it's a great book, but it's not a great heist story.
Do you know how I'd, like, the allegory I'd use? It's like he has a kit to build a house, but he built a cubby house instead.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that doesn't mean it's any less enjoyable as a fantasy narrative of, you know, fighting the system. Also, have I just become, like, a massive Brandon Sanderson defender? Like, is that what's happening right now? Am I defending all of his plot points?
Yeah, that's exactly what's happening. You are welcome to the cult.
All right, well, let's talk pacing without spoiling the book. So obviously I felt when I first read this book, the pacing, I was like, I got 60% of the way through and nothing had happened. And that's when I rage quit, because I was like, literally, I don't care. Nothing's happened. I hope they lose. I hope they don't get to overthrow the evil dictator, because they're taking forever to get their lives sorted out. How do you feel about the pacing of this book?
I think, as I said, I think that this is one of Sanderson's weak points, where if you were to draw it out on a timeline and like point to your major events, they would be rather well spursed, but there is going to be a section, and it is probably about the 60% mark, where everything is in place, he's set up the world, he's set up the characters, and now we're in the this is normal operation before the first big twist comes in. And at that moment, everything can feel quite dull.
And is that sort of where you think I rage quit from?
I would almost certainly say it was where you rage quit from. Don't think you saw the first moment where everything changes, which I don't want to spoil. And after that point, suddenly there's, you know, all the pieces need to get set back up again, and we need to figure out what's going to happen, and it gets interesting again. But there is this little section where it's like, oh, is this going to be the rest of the book?
And that's, I think, where I quit.
I think that is honestly the issue, is it's not so much that nothing happens. It's that everything gets set up and there's a clear trajectory that it's going on. And if you don't know that there's a speed hump coming or a real swerve coming, you go, I still have so much of the book to go. Is it just going to be this for the next 8 chapters on repeat?
I totally think you're on the money there. And I certainly felt just frustrated, because I was like, why am I reading this? What am I holding on for? But coming back and revisiting it, and again, graphic audio, it's condensed format. You've got actors, you've got other stuff going on that makes it really enticing. It really helped me get through that lull. And then when those twists and turns do inevitably happen, and I know that they're going to come because I saw them in Warbreaker, I was like, yeah! Or I was like, no! I actually felt invested at that point. And it's really interesting that this is obviously a structural thing for him, which is fine. I just wish maybe he just gave us a little teaser of a twist earlier on to keep us. I mean, I would hate people to come to this book and have a similar experience to me and rage quit and not actually see so many satisfying conclusions from this book. So I think that for me is my concern.
Yeah, again, I want to tie this back to Warbreaker. I think this is why I recommend Warbreaker, is that because it has those three plots going simultaneously rather than this one, which is mostly just Vin's plot. It means that there's always something to latch onto to get you through those little doldrums. So we've referenced a few times the Lord Ruler and religion and stuff. I was curious, what did you think of, in particular, the Steel Inquisitors, but also the Lord Ruler's system of religion as bureaucracy, where you have the Steel Ministry and the Obligators, who are his priests, but they're really bureaucrats.
Yeah, so it's really hectic. So at the bottom level of that kind of tier, you have obligators, right? They're like water. They're like the pencil pushers.
They're the pencil pushers, but they are also the priests of this religion that is basically, it's a tyrannical theocracy.
Yeah, that's a pretty good way to put it. I can't really think of any better way to put it. I never really got the sense it was a religion from them. And even hearing you say this now, I'm like, oh, it's much more administrative.
It's completely administrative, but it is also, that's what I find interesting about it. They are bureaucrats. They are technically priests.
It's definitely more of a political ideology rather than a spiritual ideology.
Absolutely. It's hard to not have faith in a god that can literally walk up to you. It's not an issue of faith and belief. It just is, because you can see the Lord Ruler. He's there. He's the one with the aura of despair and horribleness around him.
And he's been alive for 1,000 years.
Yeah. There's no reason to have faith or spirituality in that case, because he's there and he's got these godlike powers.
Yeah.
So you don't need that same level of priestliness. What you do need is admin for your state religion that is also the state itself.
I think it's really interesting how you sort of define it as tyrannical theology, because it really is. But then above the obligators, you've got Steel Inquisitors, who are the most hectic, like, You are 3 chapters in, and then Vin is just casually wandering through her life as she does. And she's like, oh, I passed by a Steel Inquisitor and I recognize him because of the giant spikes through his head.
These guys are horrifying. They are bald.
Yeah.
Like, incredibly powerfully built people. Tattoos around their eyes. But more importantly, they don't have eyes anymore. They've got giant railroad spikes where their eyes used to be, sticking through their head and actually poking out the back. And they just
wander around and basically force people to do the Lord Ruler's will. Because, oh, by the way, they've got the powers of a Mistborn and some other things, potentially. They are horrifying.
And they make comments in the book, how are these people alive? They've got spikes going through their brains. And it's baffling. And I don't really understand it, but I guess I don't really have to, because I assume at some point either I'll have to read a wiki or, you know, join Sanderson's cult and maybe he'll tell me. But yeah, they are horrifying. They're definitely like the muscle or like the military generals, but they don't need an army because they're like a one-man army in themselves.
I do want to mention that the Mistborn trilogy is a lot like, say, the Star Wars trilogy, where the first part of it, in this case, the Final Empire, can be read or consumed as completely standalone. It does have a whole plot arc that finishes all of its own. And if you would have ended there, that would be fine. The end of The Final Empire, if the series ended there, you'd go, oh, okay, I can see there could be more stories in there, but there's always more stories. But then it does develop into those others. So if you did want to try it out, you can just read that first book and go, all right, that's enough for me.
Yeah, I would agree with that, having finished it now.
So you would recommend this book to others?
So this one's going to be out of 11 because there's 11 medals.
Okay, yes.
So out of 11, I would give it a 9.
Okay, out of 11, I would give it an 8 of the for the 8 basic medals, I think.
Oh, that's such a cop-out.
I give it 8 basic medals out of 11 known medals. That seems fine.
All right, you want to share your favorite quote with me that you went and researched?
Oh, that's right, a thing we were doing.
Yeah.
So I had found quite a few quotes about belief relating to Sazed, and I couldn't pick one of those, so I decided I wouldn't, and I would just choose a Vin quote. That's what trust is, isn't it? A willful self-delusion.
That's a good quote.
What I like about that quote is it tells you so much about Vin's character. And it also raises questions about what is the nature of trust.
Mine is a belief one, so you're probably going to roll your eyes as I say it, because it's, I think, a very obvious one. So the one I picked is, the right belief is like a good cloak, I think. If it fits you well, it keeps you warm and safe. The wrong fit, however, can suffocate.
Yeah, that was one of those Sazed ones I had lined up as well, and there were a few others, and Sazed's questions about belief are really interesting. And as I said, I think it is one of the major themes of the book that it will make you go, or if you choose to, you don't have to engage in this topic, but you can go, what is belief and how does it impact my life?
Before we go to our spoiler chat after our outro, Jake, if people want to talk to us, where can they find us? Do you remember?
The main one I remember is sharingcontently, one word, no brackets, @gmail.com is where you can email us.
Yeah, we're also on Instagram @sharingcontently, and we're on Twitter @sharecontently because there's a character limit and we couldn't have sharing. All right, well, we might head to the outro and then the spoiler section. So if you want to go away and listen to Mistborn, please go do so, but stop listening to our podcast because we're about to talk about every plot twist and spoiler. You ready to talk spoilers?
Ooh. Absolutely ready to talk spoilers. What was the biggest twist for you? I have to ask, because there's one that sticks in my mind, but I don't think it has a lot of impact to a lot of people.
The biggest twist?
The moment that sticks with you the most that we can't talk about in the rest of the show.
Probably the Shannalarial twist, that she was a Mistborn. Or a Misting. She's a Misting, right? She only has one power.
No, she's Mistborn.
She is Mistborn, right, yeah.
No, that's the whole twist, is that she pretends to just be one of the emotional allomances.
But she's actually a full Mistborn, yeah. That's it, but so the thing is, you get the reveal of, like, Shannalarial's a Mistborn, and also you hate her because she's, like, going for Elend the whole thing, and she's really mean and nasty to Vin. And any girl who is listening to this has known a girl who has treated you like Shannalarial treats Vin, so that's why you hate her from the start. So you have the plot twist of, oh my gosh, she's a Mistborn, and then a minute later, Vin murders her, and you're like, oh my god, what is happening? So that whole scene for me was just hectic. But what about you? What was your twist?
Mine is the double whammy from Marsh. First, his death, where you show up on the scene, and it's just covered in gore and blood, and there's, like, this note left behind. And you're like, what the hell? How much of things? And then it turns out that he wasn't dead. They weren't onto him. But that he was doing so well that they recruited him as a Steel Inquisitor.
Yeah, and they shoved spikes through his head. What the hell? Oh, Steel Inquisitors, I can't. Makes me want to vomit, like, honestly.
Yeah. No, you asked favourite character, which is Caesar, but my second favourite character is Marsh. I think Marsh is really interesting for the little... Admittedly, I am somewhat biased by, as I said, future books.
Okay.
Knowing his plotline and stuff. But Marsh is really interesting, and his relationship with Kelsier is interesting, and I don't think he gets anywhere near enough screen time. I think he is really damn cool.
I agree. I would say the second, like, major plot twist that, for me, I was just like, WTF. Chandra? Question mark? What? Like, okay, so for those who are listening and know these books better than me, you're probably, like, laughing at me. But let me just try and explain to you what a Chandra is. So there is mist, and then there's these creatures called mist wraiths that sometimes can just metabolize, like, that gooey creature from Spirited Away and just absorb stuff. I forget his... Oh, No Faith. Basically is how I imagine mist wraiths.
As a D&D fan, I imagine them much more like gelatinous cubes. Or just, like, your oozes, where you can see in them shapes and bones and whatnot.
Yeah. And then their cousins or, like, similar creatures are something called Chandra, who consume corpses and then can shapeshift sort of into the person they've consumed because they put the bones in the right places to form a body around. And then it's just mental. It's like, we don't need this extra thing in this book in the third last chapter.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't want this. I get why, because it's important to have Kelsier reborn.
Yes.
Or whatever. But I'm also just like, why? Why do we need another thing? Like, it was just too much for me. And then you have to realize, this creature ate Kelsier's body to do it. And it's like, ugh, I don't know. Too far. Too far, Brandon. Too far. You lost me.
Let's see how you feel in future books, because the Chandra do play a more and more significant role as the story's going. No, they're really cool. They're really cool. Trust me. You'll love them.
I don't like them. All right. Well, fine.
Now, we alluded to it a little bit before the spoiler, but when you rage quit, did you get to the destruction of the army?
No, I rage quit after Vin's first ball, and she comes and tells Kelsier about the ball, and Kelsier's, I remember it vividly, Kelsier's internal monologue is like, oh, she's already falling in love with the boy, as in Ellen Venture, who she just met. And I was like, no, she's not Kelsier. She just met him. What is this writing? It's just, for me, I was like, done.
No, that's fair enough. See, I think I might disagree personally. I think that she was kind of falling in love because I think in this book, the romance is not well written. Like, that's the issue. It's very much a love at first sight sort of thing.
Which is fine.
But not fleshed out.
Yeah, it's just painful for me. And I didn't really like the idea of a middle-aged man looking at a 16-year-old girl and being like, oh, she's falling in love. Her position is compromised. It's like, that's not your place to make any of those judgments, even if she is. But yeah, that's where I rage quit. So no, when the army got destroyed, and I remember I was texting you about it, because I was like, this whole trilogy is them building an army and it getting, like, incrementally destroyed until the third book. I am not going to make it through. I can't listen to the plotting and machinations and troop movements and stocking of armies for three books. And thankfully, that is not the case. But I sincerely was worried.
There is still a little bit of that sort of stuff in future books, but not in that way. It plays with that, but doesn't, you don't have to focus too much on it.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Cause I was just like, it was a great twist. Don't get me wrong. I really was like, oh my gosh, of course this is what happens. Cause that is what happens historically in these movements. But yeah, I was so worried at that point. I didn't trust Brandon Sanderson. I still didn't trust him. I don't know that I trust him yet, but I'm still suspicious of him. What's your, like, absolute favorite moment in the whole book? Like the snapshot in your brain. If you think the Final Empire, what is that moment for you? Cause I know what mine is. If you want me to share mine, and I'll tell you.
Can you do yours first? Because as I said, the trilogy sort of blows a bit together for me.
Yeah, so for me, and I remember I sent you all my predictions right as I know the book's winding up. And one of my predictions was Kelsier not surviving to the end of the trilogy was my prediction. Admittedly, I didn't quite foresee him dying in the next chapter like 5 minutes later in my audiobook. But the scene where the Lord Ruler rolls into the town square and that impending sense of doom that people feel, and then the altercation with Kelsier and the moment of the Lord Ruler killing Kel, for me, I just could see it so clearly in my mind, and that's really just stuck with me.
Oh, so I have a few that have visually stuck with me. There's certainly that one. There's the battle around the Towers of Creedic Shore, the Lord Ruler's palace,
where they're all flying around fighting Steel Inquisitors and just trying to hide, and then Sazed comes out of the rain and boffs a Steel Inquisitor on the head and runs away and saves Vin's life. That's a moment that I absolutely adore. There's the wonderful duality moment, which is all about Vin's character arc of the first time where she's in Clubs' shop and the crew are meeting in the light and joking and having fun, and she just sort of hides in the shadows and doesn't know what to do. And then, like, halfway through the book, she joins them and looks over to the shadows where she used to be and acknowledges her growth. There's the balls with the stained glass windows. There's battling Shannelariel in the rain and Vin's desperate flight to stop Ellen's assassination.
That's right, yeah. And then there's also the moment when Vin gets imprisoned and she's, like, in her undergarments and Ellen comes to save her. And he's like, Vin, do you mind putting some clothes on? I'm a bit uncomfortable. And she's just so not of that world. Or, like, she doesn't really care about being naked in front of people. Like, she's just so chill. And that's just such a weird moment because you have this, like, no woman stiff upper lip and all of that training coming back. And she's just like, thanks for saving my life. It's not my fault I'm naked, but let me give you a hug, basically. And he's like, let's find your clothes.
I don't really remember that, but if that stuck with you, sure.
Oh, really? I remember just laughing.
Let's briefly talk about the book, the epigraphs, the little things at the start, the diary.
I mean, I perpetually have been so confused by this. When I read it the first time, I was confused. When I'm listening to the graphic audio, I was confused. And I must have sent you, I reckon, 20 different messages being like, I still don't understand what is going on.
So the epigraphs are a series, it's a diary, and at first you think it's written by the Lord Ruler, but it turns out to have been written by someone who was meant to be the Lord Ruler, but the guy who ended up being the Lord Ruler betrayed him and took the power that gave him the powers of immortality and the like.
Yeah, so basically they steal this, it's a journal, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then Sazed translates it. What he translates becomes, I like to imagine it as like the Reynolds pamphlet of the book, or the characters read it, and snippets of it appear at the start of every chapter. So even as you're reading the main narrative, you're getting these snippets before you even realize what it is. Love it conceptually, was very confused by it, and feel like it almost forces me to go back and reread the book or re-listen to it so I can actually piece it together in a more holistic narrative. But look, it was really insightful. I really enjoyed finding about it.
What I will generally do is the wiki is really nice and it collates them all into one place with just the text of the epigraphs.
Right.
So you can just look at that and go, oh, cool. Ah, I get it now.
So I'm really confused, as per usual, by Vin seems to have, like, weird extra abilities with Allomancy. So she gets into, I think, a fight with Kelsea because she thinks she can pierce a copper cloud. Like, is it just because she's a magical...
There's a lot going on with Vin. It's similar to how, in the end of the book, she also, like, drinks in the mist and burns the mist for superpowers. That was the thing that actually inspired Brandon Sanderson's lore. You can't use Deus Ex Machina magic powers that haven't been explained to the audience, because that one gets explained in future books, because of course everything gets explained in future books. So did you want to say goodbye to people, Lauren?
Not really. Do you want to do it?
All right, fine. Bye to people.